I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A marvelous new book is out now, is Startle and Illuminate, Carol Shields on Writing. It's a book edited by Shields' daughter, Anne Giardini, and her son, Shields' grandson, Nicholas Giardini, taken from Shields' letters, essays, notes, lectures, and various other material found in the archives. It provides wisdom on writing, publishing, fiction, reading, and generally life itself. Anne Giardini joins me now, and I'll get her to tell us about that which Carol Shields felt about writing, the writing process, and more. Carol Shields died in 2003, but leaves a tremendous legacy with this book. It's in a career that included various honors and awards, including a Pulitzer Prize. This book will serve many writers, aspiring or otherwise, as well. Anne Giardini is the author of two novels, A Sad Truth About Happiness and Advice for Italian Boys. She's working on a third, soon to be published. She is the 11th chancellor of Simon Fraser University, and she's had a distinguished career as an executive, board director, and lawyer. This new book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Ottawa today, Anne Giardini. Ms. Giardini, good morning.
Hello, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted.
The title of the book, Startle and Illuminate, I guess that's a great place to start. How did that come about?
It comes from an essay that Margaret Atwood wrote, and it spoke to the fact that there a poem, or at least a line in a poem, should startle the reader and illuminate the subject matter, illuminate the poem as a whole, actually. And so the book takes that concept somewhat further, as a reminder that good writing should, in all of its forms, startle and illuminate.
And what struck me in reading the book was Carol Shields' generosity with others. And Jane Urquhart talks about that in her introduction to the book. But when people would write her for advice, say, I mean, you were her daughter. I mean, I'm sure she was a font of advice for you and the sort.
Yes.
She always wrote back, didn't she?
She did. She kept up an enormous correspondence. And, in fact, that's one of the things that startled my son, Nicholas, when he went to the archives to begin looking for material, was just how much there was correspondence just generally with people, but also in particular with writers and on the topic of writing. And she was enormously generous. She had a remarkable capacity for openness and attentiveness and a way, when you were speaking with her, to go straight to the heart of things. And her writing reflects that too. It's never filler. There's always shimmering intelligence.
Where do you think that comes from, Anne? I mean, because a lot of us have knowledge, information, wisdom sometimes. But for someone like her, and the ability to share that, say, I mean, that must come from, say, how they're brought up. Is that the case with Carol Shields?
That's a really good question. She came from a very normal middle-class family in a safe suburb of Chicago in a time when, as she says, she didn't encounter things like garlic, or she said she didn't meet an Asian person or a black person until she left high school. She didn't have any exposure to anything other than safety, but she had a lot of exposure to books. And in fact, she did go to very good schools where they took seriously teaching and filling minds. So that wasn't a bad thing. But I think she was always, from a very young age, very clear about who she was and what she thought was important. And so clarity can cut through quite a bit. And she remained clear in that way about what was important until she died. So that was, I think, a hallmark of her life, the ability to cut through the things that many of us get sidetracked by and just stay true to a purpose.
You know, we like everything else in life, diet, exercise, and the sort, we ought to read more. And she writes in the book about, you mentioned her childhood. She talks about all the books that were in the house growing up. And what I found fascinating in one of the chapters in the book is this idea that as to what fiction does for the mind, and how that, say, well, that helped her a lot, didn't it? Not just in terms of her own writing, but life itself.
Life itself. She admits several times in the book that her own life simply wasn't enough for her. that she wanted to live in a way that was more expansive. And reading, of course, is for all of us for whom our own lives aren't enough, that we know there's more and we can get to it through reading. Of course, the books she grew up with were not very plentiful, at least the ones at home, and really, frankly, not very good. That was a basis, that was the bedrock, and it provided her with a start to first go to the library, which she adored, and expand her bookshelf and her mind. And then I was into the world, and things get wider and wider, and she had that experience of reading more and more widely and more bravely.
How many kids are you in the family?
There's five of us. She went on to have five kids, as people did in that post-war era. They filled up those houses.
Yeah. And how many of you write of the five siblings?
The most serious writer is my youngest sister, Sarah. She's a poet. She writes for young people, and she publishes quite often in Canadian Literary and other magazines. She's the best of us, I think, as a writer. She's remarkable. She publishes under the name Sarah Cassidy. And I write as well. And my sister Catherine co-wrote a play with my mother, which was produced several times. And I think that's it.
And for you, do you think it was inevitable that you would take up writing as well? I mean, and growing up with the parents that you had and your mother being Carol Shields and all, one would think, just observing this, that's something that came easy. I mean, did it?
Well, does writing ever come easily? That there's she talks about in the book about sitting down to the empty page with zeal and panic, as one does, zealous for the task, but panicking at the audacity of it. I write a little bit in the introduction to the book about the fact that in some ways writing did feel like the family business, sort of in the same sense if you had a butcher as a parent that you might take up being a butcher. And my mother did a lot to demystify the process. She showed us the keeping of notes and the making of drafts and the sitting at the empty page part and editing and all of that went with it. So she was very open about that. And you mentioned earlier her generosity, and that was a part of her generosity, that she wanted us to feel that we could participate in that process in the sense of commenting on early drafts and also just witnessing the art of creation and how, frankly, as you know, it's there's no glamour in it. It's hard work, industry, and dipping into a part of ourselves that, frankly, many of us don't go to very often, except maybe in dreams. So we saw it, and it certainly wasn't inevitable that we would become writers, because most of us didn't, but it was on offer, let's say. It was on offer, and the skill set was in view.
Yeah, and you could see the reality of it, that it wasn't what one would expect, because you saw that with Carol's work that it was hard to get published, and it was hard work.
Yes, and the heartbreak of being reviewed, or worse, not reviewed, and the vicissitudes of publishing, which have become harder. A famous Vancouver bookseller, Louise Hagar, mentioned to me the other day that in some ways she thought my mother had the best of the Canadian publishing timeline, in that it was really opening up and unfolding and expanding during her writing career. There were more possibilities and more ways to be published. And yet, when she died, the publishing industry hadn't hit the fairly hard brick wall that it has hit recently. So she was lucky. I mean, she was lucky in that way. She flourished along with Canadian literature.
Your son Nicholas is your co-editor with this book. How did you bring him into the family business, if you will?
Certainly, and that I did have that example of my mother in mind when I asked him to participate. But also, and quite usefully, he was a student at University of Ottawa, and my mother's papers are housed in the National Archives. So I felt that he was in the best position to actually go into the archives and start digging through and looking to see what he could find that might go into this book. And so we went off one day when I was visiting Ottawa to the archives and got him credentialed as a researcher with authority to go through the material, and off he went. And so that was his task, and he was good at it. The staff helped both of us navigate our way through the material, and then he came back with a trove of material potentially to include in this book about the art of writing, which included talks and essays and letters and material even from the novels and stories about the art of writing. So it's been a great collaboration for that reason, and also because I find it still very painful to deal with the loss of my mother. Quite painful. She was a big part of my life, and she died fairly young. She just turned 68. So having my son involved was a way of mediating some of that pain, because he could look at the material first or make it a more companionable process than just a solitary one.
He says in a chapter that he writes in the book about, because I guess he was 12 when she died, right?
Yes, 11 or 12, yes.
Yeah. That this process of working with you in putting this book together was that he learned a great deal about his grandmother, which I found fascinating.
He did, and I think, of course, he was just a kid when she died, and he had a relationship with her, but it was a child-to-grandparent relationship, which didn't have a chance to mature into an adult-to-adult relationship. And in the material, there's an enormous amount of correspondence to her from people around the world. And so he didn't just see the materials that she created, but saw in the materials that came to her how people thought of her and how she influenced others. And also, a lot of this material just shimmered with intelligence and ideas and possibilities and a world of really intelligence. And so he was able, as a now a young man, to see that and experience it and learn from it.
Does he want to pursue writing himself?
Well, I was teasing him this morning, but I expect him to start a novel any day now. I think he's waiting for his subject, you know. And then I told him, you know, my mother didn't publish her first novel until she was 40. I published my first one at 45. So on that trajectory, he has until 50, really,
to
get started. But he's 24 now, so I told him he could jump the gun a bit and get started. And so, yeah, I think he will. I think in the end he will write, but, you know, you have to wait for your subject. You can't write about nothing, although I guess there's been television shows about nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know how many books about nothing there are.
No, yeah. And that brings us to a great point that Carol Shields makes in this book about, say, the idea of finding the time to write, because I guess that's something that she was asked a lot, and I'm sure you're asked that as well.
Yeah.
with your career and managing to write books. I hate to say on the side, but I mean that's how
yes,
a lot
I wrote
of people
on the side.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what advice did she have for people in that regard?
Well, she had a fundamentally different view of time than almost anybody I've ever encountered. And I did put this into my introduction of the book because it formed the subject of a convocation address that she gave years ago. And it was to view time as abundant and expansive and available to be used or wasted at will, in a profligate way,
mm-hmm.
Rather than what most of us do, which is treat it as scarce and scant and insufficient and cramped and constraining. And it is a different, fundamentally different way of living life, and informed everything that she did, and my father as well. They were very well matched in this regard. They never said no. They said yes to everything. They never said they were too tired or too busy or uninterested or any of that. They were endlessly, and my father's still alive, he continues to be, endlessly open. And they didn't treat time as scant or scarce. They treated it as abundantly given to us to use as we see fit, and not to think ever that there isn't enough time to accomplish what's important to us.
And she felt that way right up to the end?
Right up to the end. Right every day, 24 hours, she lived them fully. She lived them fully. She was keen on, you know, good writing, for example, right until she died. I was reading to her from a newspaper just at the last day or so of her life, and she was trying to communicate a question to me, and she really couldn't too well. But then I understood that she wanted to know whether I was reading the Globe and Mail, and I did. I said yes, because she wanted to make sure she was hearing from a good newspaper. So that was her mind and her intelligence and her need for good information continuing right to her last hours.
You know, the other thing that I was thinking about in reading this book, and you mentioned the Globe and Mail, and we've been listening about troubles in recent days, is what she would have thought of, say, stuff happening today. And I guess the biggest thing I was wondering were the questions that she still had about writing today. And I'm curious to know if you think she still had any right up to the end there.
Questions about writing?
Yeah, because I mean, it seemed in reading the book that this is stuff that she talked about throughout her career.
Yeah,
and so at
yeah.
the beginning of her career, when she first gets published, and you know, after all the success, after all the awards, she was still thinking about the process of writing and what that was and how to do it.
Yes, how to do it well. She had a saying that I liked, which was always be as intelligent as you are. And so it doesn't say you have to be intelligent as your neighbor, just as you are, and don't waste that intelligence. And I think some of the writing that we all get distracted by these days is frankly a waste of our intelligence. I have a saying myself, which is it makes you dumber to read it. I think she would have been a little, you know, not too impressed by the way we waste time on material not worthy of our intelligence, but keen about the various ways that good, intelligent writing, like you celebrate, frankly, is enhanced and shared. So, you know, I think all of us have mixed feelings. We see some good voices coming forward that might not have come forward in a former world, but then we're awash in, you know, mediocrity as well. So we need to have her kind of clarity of vision to pick and choose to make sure we're making good choices in what we read and what we give our attention to.
I said off the top that this book will serve writers, aspiring and otherwise, well, if they read it. And I think chiefly in the area of, say, the myths that people have with regards to writing. And she talks about the stuff that paralyzes a writer that prevents a person from writing itself. She talks about, say, the advice that's good to heed and the advice that one gets that's good to dismiss. And you list some of these myths that she thought ought to be busted when it comes to writing.
Yes, well, for example, people worry about hurting others. And so she dismisses that quite quickly. Not that she ever wrote to hurt people, but tell her that, write it truly, and then you can disguise later so that people don't get hurt. It doesn't take much misdirection, magician-like misdirection, to hide what might be hurtful or change it. And she talks about the myth of writing only what you know, so she gets into that, and a number of others. People do have a number of reasons why they can't get down to it, or they, once sitting down, can't get through it. So she's got some very useful advice there. I think this is something of a friend of mine called this a sophomore book on writing rather than a freshman book on writing, because I think it assumes that you've at least tried.
Mm. Yeah, and the other thing that general readers will find fascinating is how she understood reading and readers and what readers wanted, say.
I think that's right. The book, when we thought about our audience, it's for writers, of course, but also for anyone that's interested in good writing as a reader. And in working on the material and editing the book, I came to see that a lot of the advice that's ostensibly about reading and writing is really advice about how to live your life, how to live life as a more conscious, attentive, aware, and constructive person.
Yeah, I mean, I told you off the top, I was just jotting down notes as I was reading this, because there's just a lot of wisdom here. I mean, I'm not a writer, and unfortunately don't read as much fiction as I should. But there's stuff here about how to look at life differently and more effectively.
Yeah, so she says things like this. Time isn't enough. Skills of observation and skills of language Attention to rhythm, extension of vocabulary, and distortion of syntax are required. A feeling for structure and stamina. And she goes on, those are all things we can use in any area of endeavor, yeah. not just in writing. Yeah. And an important piece for me has been, she talks about completion, because many writers ask about how do you know when you're done? When is a work finished? And she says that the end of a story is as important as anything in the process. And she says the feeling of completion, however imperfect, is what makes art. When we feel something being satisfied or reconciled or surrendered or earned. And I think that idea of completion and the way she defines it is an enormously robust one and can apply to anything we do in life, you know, a relationship or a job or any task, whether something has been achieved or earned or reconciled is a much broader concept than most of us ever think of in the, when we think about completion.
I'm sure you and Nicholas have had conversations about this process of putting this book together and him learning about his grandmother a lot more. Has he shared with you what he thought was the best advice he got from her work, from her writing?
Yes, he has said this idea of listening and paying attention. Because the material for writing is all around us. And, you know, we're famously in an era of divided and fragmented attention. And this book calls on us over and over again to pay attention. So he has said that's been the most important part to him, is that reminder of the importance. We know, but we forget.
Having lived with your mother as you have and known her work as you have and now having put together a book on her thoughts on writing, is the process of writing for you, I mean, you have two novels already, you've got a third soon to come, has that made it easier, say, for you as a writer? Or I mean, I don't know how to really put the question, but...
Oh, it's a great question. It's a great question. And I've decided that easier, that isn't what happens.
Yeah.
It never becomes easier. You think, you know, with most things, like, you know, a piano etude, you know, after the 10,000th time, it's easier. I don't know if that's true. I think the art part is always a difficult, and it has to be difficult, or else you're just doing something by rote. So I mentioned earlier that wonderful phrase, you sit down at the computer with a combination of zeal and panic, and both are essential, that tension between what you want and what you can achieve and doing something new and fresh. She talks in this book about voices from the edge. So I don't think that becomes easier, and I don't think that's the goal, and I don't think it creates a good finished product to sit down and say, oh, but now it's easy because it's my third or tenth or whatever book. I think it has to be hard, and that's the point of it. And that actually has been good for me to be reminded of, because you feel a little bit when you sit down as if you failed because it's not getting easier, whereas in fact you're not making it easy for yourself, means you're actually doing the right thing.
When she would write her her books, would get you to read them, as well as many others, along the way. For you, what was that process like? I mean, having to the chance, say, to read Carol Shields before it gets published.
It's kind of funny because I look back now and I realize I took it totally for granted. I would be looking around for that bit of manuscript that I could read and talk about with her and comment on, and I never really thought anything of it. It just was what happened around the house. So it was lovely, but it was like coming downstairs and finding a batch of cookies on the counter. I mean, it was great, but it didn't seem to me to be unusual or particularly, strange. It was just what happened in the house. But I did love it. And also, of course, we all have our egos. It was nice when in the finished book you saw the faintest trace of your fingerprint in the way she had incorporated something he had said. So that was lovely.
You write in the book that your father encouraged both you and Nicholas to pursue this book. And what's his reaction been in terms of just, say, this book being out now and what's in it?
He's been delighted. He has that same generosity of spirit that I mentioned in my mother. That's why they were so well-suited, amongst other reasons. So he loves having it out. He has the same feeling that I have. All of this, gladness floats like on an ocean of loss and sorrow. There's no way around that. We miss her terribly, and we wish we didn't have to put a book out for her, that she was putting her own books out. She had many, many good books left to write. But that doesn't change that it's great to be able to pull this project together and have this book out. And this is advice that really very few people knew about. It was known to us and a few people who happened to be lucky enough to be the recipient or maybe hear her speak. And I think we all felt that this was material that could help people and should be more widely available. So he's pleased, and as we all are in the family.
I mean, just think of people, not just Nicholas's age or younger, who haven't read Carol Shields yet, but people, say, my age, I'm a little older than Nicholas, who probably didn't read her when she was alive.
Yes.
And will get to know her a little bit better now.
I think that's true. It's a way in. And people will pick up a book or two of hers, and I don't think her books date very much, especially her ones that became more famous. The Stone Diaries, for example, is on many university programs and widely taught, and Unrest on the Republic of Love, and books that I think will be as rewarding for a new reader, a young reader, as they were for those of us that read them when they first came out.
Did she think about that, that when she was writing, that say, years from now, these books would outlive her?
No, I think of course we hoped, but, yeah. She was very modest, and she knew that most writers, when they're gone, are seen in the rearview mirror receding. That's the truth of it. But a few continue to be read and discussed and influential. And I think she did hope Stone Diaries in particular would have that kind of life, as it is proving to have, at least so far.
And letter writing, that's something that we all should do more of. And I got that in, well, not only reading this book, but the previous collection of letters with Blanche Howard.
With Blanche Howard, yes. She was an inveterate letter writer. And I was quite surprised, actually. I came across a box just last week of letters from her that I had forgotten I had. They were sent to me in my 20s, my 20s. And I had kept them. I didn't even know I had them. There were hundreds. Huh. And they were a page or two long each. They weren't short notes, by and large. They were detailed letters. And in fact, so many of them, and found so recently that I haven't even had a chance to read them yet or reread them. So I'm hoping there's more in there. Well, I know there'll be more in there, but on this topic and others. So she wrote not just to me, but to all my siblings and to colleagues and acquaintances and friends and readers. She kept up a huge correspondence. And it goes back to this question of time.
Yeah.
We're just not sure how she did it on top of writing all her books.
Yeah, it's something that we all know we should do, as I said, among other things, but we don't do enough of, and that's something that I got out of this book, it's so meaningful to get a letter nowadays, it's also, having written letters from time to time, it's awfully good to do that as well. I find so.
My friend Caroline Anderson, a very good writer in Vancouver, mm-hmm. has started a letter project with some other writers where they're sending each other physical letters. She commented on that experience that we almost don't have anymore of seeing that envelope arrive at the house or at the letterbox with a letter in it from a human being.
Yeah.
Because most of our mail is not of that caliber. So I'm hoping she's on to something. I'm hoping she's going to start a bit of a trend. She's a great person, and I think she's starting something great.
Yeah. When does your next book come out?
Well, that's a question. I have a finished third novel that has not come out the way I wanted it to, so I'm looking at it and trying to decide what to do with it. I started a new third novel. Can you have two third novels? That's a question I have. Following this novel, let's say 3A, I'm following my mother's advice in this book, which is to write a page or two a day, edit the previous day's page or pages, and then write the next ones. And if each of us were to do that for a year, we would each have a finished book at the end of the year, a book being approximately of that length. So I'm doing that with this new novel, and I'm co-writing a mystery with a friend. So lots of projects.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and I've admired your work over the years.
Thank you, Joe.
This book is such a wonderful book. Congratulations, and good luck to you and Nicholas on it.
Thank you for having me on this, and good luck to you as well.
Thank you. The book is called Startle and Illuminate, Carol Shields on Writing. It's from Random House. One of its editors, Anne Giardini, joined me on the line from Ottawa. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.